Bruce, let's start with you. Why do you believe our notion that Indigenous Australians were simply hunter-gatherers is a false one?
Well, I think the evidence is in the explorers' journals. What they first saw when they entered the country wasn't hunter and gathering so much as a form of agriculture. Mitchell saw 9 miles of grain being grown, a monoculture, and the grain had been cut and stooked. Gregory actually saw it being irrigated. These aren't the activities of hunters and gatherers.
Bill, why do you agree?
Yeah, Bruce's book has got evidence from all over Australia, thousands of quotes, and quite clearly observant early travellers, notably the explorers, saw and recorded evidence of agriculture, not only with grain, but with tubers and aquaculture. I think the evidence is so overwhelming that the surprise is not that I'd agree, but that people haven't dropped to this before.
Bruce, how widely used were these complex systems you describe? Are we talking all across the continent?
We are. The entire continent was used. In fact, in Sturt's Stony Desert, when Charles Sturt first went there, on the barren banks of the Warburton River, people were using the river bed as a grain-growing district, and saved his life by providing him with water and roast duck and cakes. That the cakes had been made from that grain. The most inhospitable part of Australia, and Aboriginal people were running an agricultural society.
I had a chat before the program today with Uncle Max Harrison, who's a senior lawman from the south coast of New South Wales, and I spoke to him about what he remembers being told as a child in the middle of last century.
Some of us young fellows were going over fishing somewhere, you know, some of the uncles and aunties would sing out, "Where are you going?" "Oh, we're going over here, you know, fishing for, you know, drummer or whatever it was, you know." And I say, "Well, look, while you're over there, you know, there's a in that area, at this particular place, you know, you go about 4 or 5 crevices away, and you get the mutton fish out of there." See, we called abalone mutton fish. So we knew where we had to go and get it, and you know, and there could be plenty more abalone elsewhere, but we were directed where to get it, you know, and so we'd do it.
Were there some places you weren't allowed to go?
Well, there was, yeah, but you don't muck the system up, see?
What do you mean by you don't muck the system up?
Well, it's like if you got a it's collecting berries and fruits and that. If you walk along and you see the berries and fruits and that, you know, you shake the plant or the vines or the tree 3 times, if the fruit and the berries fall off, it's yours. If it doesn't, then it's not yours, you know. And then you take what has fallen down. So you never plucked them off. And that was the same as how they used to have that system of gathering the abalone, well, the mutton fish, you know. They would take some out of there and then they wouldn't. Then they would move to another area, you know, not just the next crevice, but one, you know, further away somewhere. So you always kept the food in the appropriate places. See, it's just like when you're walking into a supermarket, you're walking in, you're looking up to see the name of the food that you're gonna get, you know. And then you walk down and just those aisles are all that got food in it. Well, that's the same system that the old fellas used in hunting and gathering, you know? Same system.
That's Uncle Max Harrison, a senior lawman from the south coast of New South Wales. We'll hear more from Uncle Max a little later. Bruce Pascoe, since writing this book, have you had more Indigenous people come forward and tell you what they were told when they were growing up?
Yeah, that's the great thing about it, is that the majority of the people who've written to me about Dark Emu have been Aboriginal people. and telling me about their days in Western New South Wales, where they remember the old people harvesting grain in their lifetime. So it was great to hear those stories, and they just back up all the stories that I use in the book that have come directly from the explorers, and they come from every corner of Australia. But what Uncle Max was saying, and Uncle Max is a teacher of mine, that there was law governing how the land was to be used and how the provision of the land was to be allocated.
But how many of the stories would be stories of actual farming rather than just stories of gathering?
Well, the gathering stories have taken over somewhat from the farming stories, because gathering was all that was left to people once the land was taken away. You couldn't do broadacre agricultural activities once the land had been taken from you. So you were eventually gathering. But if you read the explorers' journals, you can see that the preponderance of the economic activity was large scale and involved cultivation. Around Melbourne, for instance, Beatty saw that the hills had been contoured during the process of digging up Yamdaisi. This was a dramatic alteration of the landscape to make use of the Yamdaisi plant.
Bill, you've drawn on journals and writings by early European white explorers and surveyors in your work as well, in The Biggest Estate on Earth. Why is it important to draw on the white documents of history rather than just the oral traditions of Indigenous Australians?
Well, can I say first that I think the skill in which Aboriginal people gathered food and resources is very well known. The key point is that they actually organised the landscape so as to make those resources predictable. It wasn't a matter of just harvesting grain. As Bruce said earlier, Mitchell's on the Narran River, and he says, "We rode 9 miles through this grass only and as far back as the eye could see." This grass only, that's clearly a crop. There are no weeds, there are no other plants. In other words, it's been organised so that the gathering is really the end point of a very sophisticated farming process. And the reason for going back to the earliest possible records is firstly to show how widespread and how diverse these farming practices are, and secondly to make sure or to guard against the possibility that some readers might think that Aboriginal farming was influenced by the Europeans. So if you have later records, then people might say, "Oh, they learnt that from the Europeans," whereas with the very early records, it's impossible to be anyone but Aboriginal people.
Since you've brought up Major Mitchell, let's hear an excerpt from Bruce's book, Dark Emu. This is explorer and surveyor Major Thomas Mitchell describing the land around Belyando River, that's in central Queensland, and this is a description from back in 1848.
"We crossed some patches of dry swamp where the clods had been extensively turned up by the natives. These clods were so very large and hard that we were obliged to throw them aside and clear the way for our carts to pass. The whole resembled ground broken with the hoe. There might be about 2 acres in the patch we crossed, and we perceived at a distance other portions of the ground in a similar state."
So there's an excerpt from Bruce Pascoe's book, Dark Emu. Bill, you've also drawn on European artworks in the past as well to support your argument. What do European artworks tell you about the management of the landscape?
Well, I think they're wonderful evidence. First of all, you have to overcome prejudice among art specialists that these paintings are romanticised landscapes. And you can do that by going to the site and comparing then and now, and you can see how accurately the landscapes were depicted. The other advantage of them is that the artists are observing what Aboriginal people are doing without realising really what they're up to. And so they're quite unconsciously, not deliberately or not with prejudice, depicting Aboriginal farming and land management activities, and for that reason they're extremely valuable. And of course what you can see convinces people. It's very convincing evidence.
But why are you so sure there is no prejudice in the art world? Because that is the argument you hear, isn't it? That the European painters in particular were influenced by their European upbringing, and that seeped into their work.
Well, there's less prejudice of that kind than there was, and of course there are some highly romanticised Australian art paintings, but you can check then and now and see that that claim so commonly made is simply not true. Indeed, it's not true of the UK, where this movement's supposed to have come from. People can go to where John Constable painted landscapes, for example, and match then and now, and the same thing was going on in Australia. I mean, if you're a squatter, wealthy man, you hire a painter to paint your landscape, and he gets it wrong, you're going to tell him, and you might not pay him. So obviously people are going to go to the trouble of painting the land accurately, and the people accurately.
Bruce Pascoe, how important do you think European artwork, early settler artwork, is to telling the story of the complexities of Indigenous land management and agriculture?
Well, I was impressed with Bill's book, how it refers to those paintings and going to the sites and recognising rocks and individual trees that are still there to show that the landscape was a managed landscape. Because when I went to school, I'd been told that the English painters simply came out here with English technique and couldn't paint the Australian bush, because what they painted was open and grassy and like an English park. And Australian art teachers in my era were telling us this couldn't have been so, because now we've got a lot of scrub and large forest. But that wasn't what it was like. So these paintings are actually important documents.
But if the landscape was open and grassy rather than the bush we think of today, what does that actually tell you? Or how does that inform you about the land practices that were going on?
Well, when Mitchell came across Australia Felix, he climbed a small hill and looked to his west, and the entire plain was covered in yellow, and he called it herbs. But in fact, it was Microceris lanceolata. It was the yam daisy. The entire field was covered in a monoculture of yam daisy, and he saw Aboriginal people harvesting the yam. This is a massive enterprise, and so we have to use those paintings to verify the fact that what Mitchell said he saw, he actually did see.
You're listening to Bush Telegraph. With me is Bruce Pascoe, who's the author of a relatively new book called Dark Emu, Black Seeds, Agriculture or Accident. And I'm also with Bill Gammage, who's a historian and the author of The Biggest Estate on Earth, How Aborigines Made Australia. And we're challenging the premise today that Aboriginal Australians were hunter-gatherers, and suggesting that perhaps there was much more intricate land management and cultivation and trading as well of food that that went on. We've got lots of examples to go through during the program today, but I want to get a little bit more of an insight into Indigenous plants and their uses. So in order to get that, I went and visited Beth Gott. Now, Beth is an adjunct research fellow at the Department of Biological Sciences at Monash University, and she developed the Aboriginal garden there. So I paid her a visit to learn more about the garden and the plants in it.
This garden contains not just food plants, it contains plants that were used for any sort of function. It particularly plants that were used for medicine, or the plants that were used for fibre, or plants that were used for fruits, or the underground roots, which in the Melbourne area, where underground plant storage roots were more important for food than, say, in Central Australia, where grains from grasses are much more used.
Well, can we go for a bit of a wander, Beth, and have a look at some of the plants, and maybe if you could explain for us what some of them are used for?
This is burrowing, and it's a plant which looks like a palm, but is actually related to the conifers, and they have male and female cones, and there are when the female cone is ripe. It's big and has a seed in it like a very big pine nut. Cooks very well, but it has to be, this particular one has to be pounded up and washed to get the plants that are the parts of the plant, that which is like a pine nut, as I said, but it has to be washed to get the things out that don't agree with one's diet. The burrowing is managed by the use of fire, as fire was one of the most important tools in the management of plants.
Beth, I wanted to ask you about a couple of plants. Bootlace bush, for instance, what was it used for?
Oh, bootlace bush is one of the primulias, and it's a plant which has a very tough and strippable bark. And so, because it's so tough, if you break a bootlace, you can use this as a substitute, and that's why it's become bootlace bush.
But the bootlace bush, what would it actually, the fibre, what would that have been used for?
Oh, it would be, well, for fibre. Fibre is very important for people who are walking over the country. First of all, you need baskets to carry things in. You need to bind stone axes to a handle. And each fibre plant, because they all have fibre in different forms, will be used for different things. You might use a fibre for making a basket, and another plant you might use just for tying things up. Mm. And I can show you one over here that is used for tying things up. This is called the flax lily. The flax lily we have found in conjunction with a bone burial in central Victoria. And there was a bag into which the bones were put, and the bag was tied at the top with this plant. The flax lilies, you notice that all you need to do is to run your fingernail along there, and you can get it in two pieces, and you then just twist that into a two-ply, well, it's a two-ply twine, really, and it's very, very strong. And there are, flax lilies are quite common. There are some plants that we can use easily because these are nice and smooth to work with. But you would have, even though a plant was good for fibre, you might avoid it if when you run your finger along it, it cuts.
So that the flax lily there used for making bags, weaving bags, that sort of thing?
Yes. Mm. Well, it was used for that, and it was used for tying, making a string to tie things up. And we actually found the bag with the bones in it tied up with this. Of course, it was at that stage very dry, but by soaking it in water we could recover the anatomy of the plant and realise that by comparison it was this particular plant that was used.
What about the bones?
Huh?
What did the bones belong to?
Oh, the bones belonged to probably a valued person. They were
human bones?
Yes, people would often carry bones around in a little bag if they belonged to someone who was valued. And it was, if I can remember rightly, it was the bones of a young woman. And those bones were treasured. They were put into a little niche, in a little dry niche in a stony cliff area. There, in that dry, beautifully dry spot, people had put the bones of someone they cherished, and they had put the bones in a bag which was made from the inner stem of the inner bark of a wattle, and then was tied up with the flax lily.
Beth Gott at the Aboriginal Garden at Monash University in Melbourne. Beth's adjunct research fellow at the Department of Biological Sciences there. Bill Gummidge is still with me. Bill, Beth referred to the use of fire to manipulate plants. How complex was fire used? How complex was the use of fire?
Let me say first, Beth is a national treasure. You know, her evidence makes so clear that how carefully Aboriginal people looked after plants. And she mentioned the burrowang. That's an example of a plant that's cultivated with fire. It needs fire to flourish, and there are many other plants, hakeas, callistemons, and which need fire to flourish. But as well as that, Aboriginal people use fire to distribute plant communities like grass or open forest across the country. And the reason for doing that was to associate food for animals with shelter for animals. The most common example is you create grass, which is food for grazing animals like kangaroos. You put next to it an open forest, which is their shelter. That encourages the kangaroos or the grazers to come from the shelter onto the grass. And then you burn the grass, and a fortnight later you get this sweet, fresh growth that lures the kangaroos to that particular spot, and then they can be, first of all, that makes them abundant because they've got plenty of good tucker, and they can be harvested more easy. So an extremely complicated fire management system, absolutely crucial to Aboriginal land maintenance, and again, across the whole of Australia, including Tasmania.
I wonder if the complexities are underappreciated amongst many as well. My guests on Bush Telegraph, Bill Gummidge, who's a historian and the author of The Biggest Estate on Earth, How Aborigines Made Australia, and also author Bruce Pascoe, whose new book is Dark Emu, Black Seeds, Agriculture or Accident. You're listening to Bush Telegraph. Well, Bruce and Bill, it wasn't just agriculture and the use of plants where Indigenous Australians used their ingenuity. There's still evidence of the extensive aquaculture and fishing systems. Now, you both mention in your books the fish traps at Brewarrina in New South Wales and the eel traps at Lake Conder in the Western District of Victoria. A couple of people with extensive knowledge of the significance of Lake Conder are Heather Bild, an archaeologist whose work in the 1990s on the site is still considered groundbreaking today, and also Jimmy Onus, whose grandfather told him how the eel traps were used. Welcome to both of you. It's nice to have you on the program. Jimmy, what do you remember being told by your grandfather?
Well, I remember that he told us that we used to get the eels and how important they were to our diet and our way of living. And we use it for various things. It wasn't just food. We also use the oil for to keep them warm and to keep even to keep insects away and things like that as well, yeah.
How did you catch them?
We caught them. We had we had some fish traps that had been built a long, long time ago by our ancestors, and they would, in the old days, they'd put these nets at the end of them, and they would catch the eels like that.
Heather, but what remains of the traps today?
What remains is the non-organic foundations that form the structure of the whole system. And because it was built on across a lava flow, it was beautiful because there was the material available to actually get your structure there. And because it was rock-hard lava, it wasn't possible to do it without the rocks as your basis for your foundation, whether it was the little dwellings or the fish trap systems themselves. They couldn't go into the earth because the earth stopped very quickly. So the rock was used just as building material, and it's there to this day because it was non-organic. It's still there, and that gave the whole story away.
Dwellings, were there dwellings as well as the traps?
Well, This was a marvellous system of, I'm talking about the Mount Eccles lava flow now, at least I've mapped 100 square kilometres of man-made, cultural, managed, constructed, modified land, which ended up resulted in a network of channels and connected wetlands, the wetlands themselves, all in a mosaic, but they were not natural. The wetlands had been dammed up to ensure that the water stayed in them in times of dry drought, which happened in the last 4,000 years. So around these wetlands, the little houses and storage areas were positioned, and they could be right up to 2 metres from the edge of a wetland because the nature of the lava flow meant that the land was well drained. It didn't get boggy. You were either in the water or you were on dry land. And it was the perfect conditions, along with the migrating eel, shortfin eel, for a whole community network, whatever you want to call it, to develop, a whole society to develop.
Well, like a fishing village.
Yes, but there were many villages. There were, I think, I don't know, thousands of people were kept very well, and they were able to be permanently living there. And because of the wetland, the water bodies, it meant that you could grow aquatic plants. And I say grow because the people could live permanently on the corms and tubers that would grow all year round in water, whereas on the land, on terrestrial woodland, it was only spring where you got the growing of the bulbs. So it was a beautifully managed system.
It challenges the idea of nomadic Indigenous people, doesn't it? The idea of a reasonably permanent village.
That's exactly right. 3 out of 4 seasons, people could live there, or, you know, substantially well and sustainable. I think what I've been listening to, it's been really fantastic. And what has come out of it is that the Indigenous people were harvesting at a sustainable level. And that kept the whole system working beautifully in balance with the people and the resource and the society. And that's what was happening on this lava flow. It was based on the environmental opportunities, which was reliable rainfall, the means to actually build infrastructure, and water. Spring, they harnessed the spring water that came up because of the lava flow. Water has trapped underground, and when it came up, this was all controlled, and it was either flood control in times of great water, or else it was drought control by the damming of the wetlands.
But Heather, how old have you been able to date? How old do you think the dwellings and the eel traps are?
What we do know, we know that the system first was available to be used exactly 8,000 years ago, when the ice age was over and the rain was coming down. It meant everything was in place for it to start. There has been trap dated there on the lava flow to 6,600. So when we did some work, we envisaged the system could have begun. And I think it developed slowly, obviously, and over the thousands of years ended up in this very complex maximum system of obtaining resources.
So a system potentially as old as 6,600 years. Give me some context here. How compare that to, say, the pyramids, something we all think of as being very, very old.
Yes, well, what are they, 4,000 or 5,000? I think
so older than the pyramids.
Older than the pyramids. These people have been managing. But you know what's really exciting about this place is that because of the nature of the eels, the shortfin eels, they have migration where they go back to sea when they're at their fattest with the highest protein and oil level. These people were catching them in traps. They had ensured that the eels had to go through these traps to get back to the main river to go to sea. But they had hundreds of thousands of eels come through in a few weeks. So what they did, they actually were able to preserve these eels by processing them by smoking inside the hollowed viminalis trees, the manugum, that they'd hollowed out to be wider, bigger than a normal hollow tree. And they were smoking chambers. And so then they had all these beautiful eels that were high in protein and smoked and preserved, and they could then exchanged them, trade them, store them.
Stored and traded. It's quite a sophisticated system.
Yeah. We have a commodity here just as any commodity in our society.
It's like our like our farming systems today, what you're describing there.
Exactly.
Jimmy, your great-grandfather was the last chieftain of the local tribe. So does that mean he would have lived in one of the dwellings, the structures that Heather described?
Yes, he did. My grandfather actually took me when I was a small boy over to Lake Conda, and he showed me where King Billy, who was the last known chief of that area, and his father before him, Bom Bom, who was also a chief, where they lived on the lake. And there's only the whole huts aren't there now, but just the bases are there. And they're still there, and you can see with the naked eye exactly what they are and how they lived.
Heather, is it likely that there, or how likely is it that there are more of these agricultural or aquacultural sites, enterprises that exist elsewhere around Australia?
Oh, listen, there are. I've just recently been working in another part of Australia, and I am blown away by what I've actually discovered. I can't talk about it now. I'm trying to get someone to support
me. Come on, give us a bit of an idea.
Okay, I'll give you a bit of an idea. It's to do with the Cooper Creek system, and it's just extraordinary what the people did there that is unknown, and it's unknown now because of the use of the nature of the land use post European arrival. So we had pastoralists come in, and we know that there was massacres. We know there was killing because they wanted this land. And then lately it's oil and gas exploration happening up there. So the people, well, not only the dairy people or other people there, it's also researchers can't get in there, and they don't realise what I'm seeing by working out there. And it's, oh boy, it's another story. So I believe that across this continent there are many of these such stories, and a lot of it, because we didn't have building stones like Mount Eccles, it's disappeared. It's like dirt and earthworks were used. There were plenty of earthworks, all to do with obtaining a surplus resource, not just hit and run, catch a kangaroo and finished. It's all about managing the land. Now, it's disappeared under European farming techniques or whatever else has occurred on that land. But I think through archaeological means and the old stories, like Bruce and Bill are gathering these old stories from the explorers, we can put together a bigger picture than what we've already got, I think.
Oh, Heather, make sure you tell us first when you've got more information, okay?
Yes, I'd love to.
If people have got examples of this type of enterprise that they're familiar with around Australia, let us know at RNBushTally on Twitter. Make sure you share your stories and your knowledge of the country with us here. Heather, thanks so much for coming in. Been great chatting with you. Heather Bilt is
pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Heather Bilt's an archaeologist who work around Lake Conda in the 1990s is still considered very, very significant. And Jimmy Onus, thanks for joining us today as well, Jimmy. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Jimmy Onus's grandfather told him how the eel traps around Lake Conda used to work. Interesting stuff, isn't it? There is actually hope that one day there'll be a commercial eel industry developed around Lake Conda. It's one of a number of projects around the country where attempts are being made to tap into the ancient knowledge and develop a commercial industry. One crop that Bruce mentions in the book Dark Emu is the potential for native rice. Our reporter, Caddy Brain, who's in Darwin, went along to hear about how one project is progressing in the Northern Territory.
When you think about rice, you think of this. Your normal white rice that you see in a packet on the supermarket shelves. But in a small laboratory out the back of Charles Darwin University is container after container of a rice that looks a bit different.
Even when I was pouring that, I could hear the difference in the sound of, you know, pouring that rice, you can see. And this rice is a much gentler sound, softer.
It's a really beautiful grain, almost like a wine red, purpley-brown sort of colour. And it's a smaller grain than cultivated rice.
So unlike rice that you'd buy in a packet, which is all a very similar size, the grains are actually quite variable. They also sort of break quite easily as well.
And why does this look so different? Well, this is native Australian rice, wild rice that exists naturally across northern Australia. And it's been the focus of more than 20 years' work for Dr. Penny Warm.
I actually didn't know about native rices myself before I moved here. So I actually got to know wild rice, and I have to say fall in love with wild rice, during my PhD project in the 90s.
How many types of native rice exist in Australia?
There's actually four species that have been found in Australia. Two of them are very common on the floodplains in monsoonal floodplains. There's one annual and one perennial species. Their Latin names are Oryza, that's the genus, and that's the same as the cultivated rice that you buy in the shop, that's also Oryza. Meridionalis, which is an annual species, and Oryza rufipogon, which is a perennial species. In addition to that, further south, in the slightly drier areas, but still within streams and rivers within those areas, are a third species, which is perennial, called Oryza australiensis. And the fourth species has only been found once in eastern Arnhem Land, and it could be perhaps a misidentification, but it's thought to be a fourth species.
And it's been harvested and consumed in the Top End for thousands of years. But how exactly? No one's really sure. Lorraine Williams is a Larrakia woman who's been working with Penny to research how native rice may benefit Indigenous communities.
When I say working on it, I'm more eating it than anything else and knowing it from as a kid growing up. But, you know, when I was sitting here doing the work, I was thinking to myself, how would old people have done this in the old times, you know? Because I look at the process and all the machinery that we're using, I'm thinking there must be an easy process, surely. You know, we were getting tarpaulins full of all this wild rice, and I'm thinking in the old days, old people would have harvested. They wouldn't have harvested with an airboat, probably would have been out in a canoe and would have been hand harvesting it, and they probably would have got a good size, good amount, depending on how many people they would have been needing to feed. But if you could imagine just even that amount, that is a lot of work that goes into, you know, dehusking all of that. And this has still got the husk on it, but it's still pretty prickly and, like, gets caught up in your hair and in the back of your shirt and everywhere. It actually stings a lot. So 20 years ago I should have been asking old people how to prepare wild rice, but it's one of those things you don't normally ask about. So with working with the Puttacal mob or the Woolna people out at Fog Dam, you know, I was trying to ask those questions of, you know, what do we call it? Old lady was able to give me a name for, Larrakia name for this wild rice, which I think is Dinganda. But feeling sad talking to her about it, because had I have asked that question 20 years earlier, I might have been able to get the answer to the question. But of course, when you're young, you don't ask old people those questions and you lose out on information.
Fog Dam seems to be a particularly important place where some of this research is done, and obviously native species are found. Can you tell us a little bit about that spot and what it looks like?
Fog Dam, oh wow, it's a beautiful floodplain. I remember it as a kid. My father would take me out that way and we'd go hunting mainly for magpie geese. So the wild rice is also a good food source for magpie geese. Out that way, it's just beautiful, beautiful floodplains. You get those beautiful stands of wild rice. And at this time of year now, the wild rice would be coming up.
Penny, coming back to you, what do we know about the nutritional value of native rices like this?
We've actually done a previous project funded by Rural Industries Research Development Corporation to look at the nutritional value. And what we found that it's extremely nutritious, slightly more nutritious than cultivated rice samples we use. So what we did was we bought samples from the shop and samples from the field, and we compared all of those at a commercial lab. And, yeah, found that it was very high in nitrogen and others in phosphorus and other sort of nutrients that you look for in food, and with no sort of problematic nutrients in there that we could identify. So, and that's often, I think, the case with wild versions of food, is that they are a little bit more nutritious because they've not been selected for other traits that can lead to changes in that nutritional status.
Because based on just the appearance of it, and also we saw some photographs earlier of what it looked like when it was cooked up, prepared with prawns and other side dishes, when could we possibly see it in a supermarket, or what kind of markets could really exist for a native rice like this? Lorraine, I might ask you.
Yeah, I'm just trying to think. There's probably some niche markets there. Mm. Gourmet food in the restaurants, I suppose, and packaged up, maybe even 100-gram package. We're still thinking about the size and how much you could charge for that particular packet. So
you can't buy it yet, though, can you?
No, we can't buy it yet, but the trials are still happening. So to take it and then maybe to have Aboriginal people can make money and be able to market their produce is a good way to go.
You mentioned price then. Mm. The amount of work it takes to dehusk at the moment is obvious. Mm. Penny, can you describe to us what it takes to actually dehusk one?
Yeah, sure. So to actually produce what we've done so far, and this is just at a trial scale, it's cost about $120 a kilo. Yes, there you go. So that's not going to be in the supermarket stalls. So it's probably never going to be like, you know, kilo packets. It will always be, as Lorraine said, a sort of niche, specialist, culturally identified product. It's always going to be quite labour intensive. But what we'd like to do next is look at milling technologies or a special mill that will cope with the size and irregularity and the nature of the husk.
So you can't use the same kind of milling technology that it already exists for cultivated rice?
No, the mill doesn't quite work as well, so we end up with 30% of seeds that still have their husk on them, a certain fraction that are broken, and then intact seeds. So then it involves a hand sorting phase after you've actually milled it. That's the phase we need to get rid of. That's the labour intensive phase.
I wonder if they'd be tempted to give it a go in the Riverina, where our rice is grown extensively at the moment. That was Penny Warm from Charles Darwin University, and you also heard from Lorraine Williams, a Larrakia woman who's been working on the Wild Rice Project. Our reporter there was Caddy Brain. You're listening to Bush Telegraph. You're on RN and Radio Australia, and today we're challenging, if you like, this notion that Indigenous Australians were simply hunter-gatherers. We're looking at the sophisticated agricultural techniques that were in place around Australia prior to white settlement. With me is Bruce Pascoe, who's the author of a book called Dark Emu, Black Seeds, Agriculture or Accident, and also Bill Gammage, who's a historian and author of The Biggest Estate on Earth, How Aborigines Made Australia. Bruce, I was interested listening to that piece about the rice there. I wonder if you know of many other efforts to commercially develop any of these traditional crops or enterprises.
Well, it was lovely listening to Beth Gott talk before, because I've relied on her work for 20 years and I've never heard her voice before, and the same with Heather Bilt. But Beth's work on the yam daisy has been very important, because from that we've been able to get seeds that we'd never been able to get before, and subsequently go out into the bush and identify exactly the same plant that was Microceros lanceolata. And we've been growing yam daisy down in East Gippsland, Aboriginal and non-Aboriginal people, and doing field trials. And I'd be really surprised if you couldn't take a bag of yam to a local market and sell it immediately. It's easy to harvest. It grows easily. It grows in Australian conditions, doesn't need fertiliser or pesticide.
Yeah, but how's it taste, Bruce? That's the important bit.
I cooked some in a curry last night, and it stands up to cooking really well. It doesn't break down into a mush like potato, and the taste is fantastic. I'm addicted to them.
Bill, how much potential is there here? Are we really talking, if these projects, these ideas are developed further, that there could be a considerable change in agriculture in Australia?
Well, there's certainly tremendous potential in these things. Whether scientists and the others take it up is, an open question. On your earlier question about whether Europeans like it, the early evidence is yes, they did. They ate the rice, they ate the yams roasted, and they said they tasted very nice. But the other thing is that they expand the potential of land potential of Australia. For example, the New South Wales government botanist Fred Turner was working in the 1890s, and he recommended a whole series of native grasses that could be commercially developed. This is the 1890s, millet, Mitchell grass, bull Mitchell grass, and curly Mitchell grass, a couple of those. And one of the great advantages of those grains is that they're perennial, as Bruce points out, and they grow in more arid country than our grains. We've been experimenting for what, since Farrow in 1882, to shift wheat and barley and oats onto ever drier country. These grains are already there. So that fact alone, I think, makes grain, native grains have a considerable commercial potential. And then, as Bruce points out, the yams and other tubers, it's only one of several in the wetter country, which could be developed and which Europeans find nutritious and tasty.
One of the issues that is brought up in Bruce's book is the need to protect cultural knowledge and also to protect physical sites like the eel traps we discussed earlier. Now, it was mentioned by Heather that perhaps a lot of landowners would not even be aware or recognise some of the less obvious sites that have links to Indigenous agricultural practices. In the Mallee country of Victoria, there's attempts being made at the moment to, I guess you'd say, educate landholders about how they can help in the preservation of these sites. The Mallee Catchment Management Authority last year released a field guide for farmers on how best to manage pests on land that may also hold evidence of Indigenous land practices. Our reporter Sophie Malcolm met up with the authority's Indigenous facilitator, Ken Stewart, to ask him what lies hidden on the land.
In 2012, we received funding to investigate pest animals in cultural value sites, so shell middens, which we're looking at today, mounds, burial sites, even scar trees to have an impact. So we put a field guide out, not just for government workers, farmers, and for ourselves as well as Indigenous people to know how to work with the sites in the area.
What kinds of animals are causing damage?
These wild goats in the national parks, they cause damage, you know, coming herds, even rubbing up against trees, you know, and scar trees are significant. Do they tell you a story? Every cultural value site has a story to it. Rabbits, they're everywhere. Feral pigs, you know, if you're on water, the water and that, they're causing a great problem. We're actually looking at a shell midden that's very dispersed, a lot of broken up stuff, but it's just over time. But if you look at certain areas, you can see it in situ in layers, and then you have soil on top, then another layer. It shows a continued connection. They keep coming back because this is a very rich food source. And that bush here, that's what I was just talking to you about before, is the ruby salt bush, or sneezeweed. And they're little bush tomatoes. They're very high in vitamin. And as I always say, not a lot to put on your sandwich, but they do taste very good, actually. If you look at the billabong there, you know, there's shells, mussels, there's fish in there, there's probably yabbies, stuff like that. So that was a really good market.
So have you heard from farmers who are maybe coming across these sites and these artefacts on their properties?
Today, actually, I got an email asking to go and talk because a lot of the farmers have material that they don't know what to do with. So, you know, their father or their grandfather's had this stuff, and so I'll go and give them advice, run through the book and give them guidance so they get a better understanding. You know, if you can teach and educate people, you're going to be far better off. I've worked on farms when I was a kid, and now I go back there today and I can actually see mounds being grounded, graded in, stuff like that. So just getting people to work within the act.
How often do you think you would see maybe sites like these that are on farms or maybe bordering farms in places like this?
In the northwest area here, we have a high number of Indigenous sites. You know, we're looking up around 8,000 sites recorded in the Mallee CMA area, so that's a fair bit of work to do.
So what are you hoping the guide will help achieve?
I think the guide can achieve a lot, and we've had really good response from different groups. Even right across Victoria, people have asked us for a copy of the guide, and it's a guide to manage your land and Indigenous culture.
That's our reporter Sophie Malcolm speaking with Ken Stewart from the Mallee Catchment Management Authority. Bill Gummidge, before I let you and Bruce go, I want to ask you how divided historians are on this topic, and particularly on the issue of just how extensive Indigenous land practices actually were, because no doubt there'd be some that disagree with what you and Bruce have been arguing today.
I haven't encountered any historians who disagree. I mean, they're responsive to the overwhelming evidence that Bruce and I have in our books, and they generally accept it. I mean, their most common response is that they hadn't thought of it. I suppose the people who least like it agree as some of the ecologists, clearly not people like Beth and so on, but there are others who are not convinced, and I think that's because they're unfamiliar with historical evidence.
Before we wrap up, I want to hear the final word today. I know there's lots more we could talk about on this topic, but I just want to give the final word to Uncle Max Harrison, who we met earlier. Uncle Max is the senior lawman from the south coast of New South Wales. And I want a final word from Uncle Max. Here he is talking about how animals were actually trapped for food.
You ought to know the particular animal dreaming track, you know, so that you can channel them into where you wanted them, you know. And that was another great system, just so that, you know, you didn't have to run your guts out, you know, trying to chase these, you know, especially kangaroo and emu and, you know, all the other wallabies and that, you know.
So what would a wallaby or kangaroo trap look like?
You could be looking at it while you're walking through the bush. It's just like a big clump of bush, you know, and it was systematically set up, you know, so that when the animal didn't struggle through and it just veered off into the clearing, you know, it was into an area where some of the young fellas can either catch him or, you know, hit him with a spear, you know. But the art of grabbing them by the tail, you know, was a wonderful challenge, you know. Once you grab the kangaroo and emu by the kangaroo or wallaby by the tail, you know, and see they couldn't do anything, and they just hopped around and around, until they got exhausted, you know. You sort of knew what size, you know. Yeah, that'll feed up all us, you know. No good at killing something when I wouldn't feed everyone, so you would have probably had to let him go. And, you know, just look at the size and that. Yeah. So just doing little things like that, you know. And many, what I call the method in their madness, you know, was so accurate in their mansions, you know, and just about to participate, you know, in doing things with them, you know.